Tonight on the Daily Debrief, a plainclothes officer shoots and kills a stranded black motorist. An attorney for the victim's family joins us for analysis. And
we haven't been with our mother for 13 years while he gets to go free.
A verdict in the case of a Florida man accused of killing a mother to help out his friend, the victim's ex-husband. Plus, did a California quadruple murder suspect try to skirt the rules while communicating with jailhouse visitors? The nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Thursday, February 28th. Good evening, everybody. I'm Aaron Keller. Welcome to The Debrief this Thursday evening. Day three of testimony in the trial of a Florida police officer who faces an attempted murder charge for shooting and killing a stranded African-American motorist. Newman Raja also faces a charge of manslaughter regarding the 2015 shooting death of Corey Jones. Jones was stranded on the side of an interstate exit ramp. Raja shot him and claims self-defense. One critical piece of evidence in this case is a police recording of the defendant just hours after the shooting. It shows Newman Raja himself describing the events. Pay very close attention to the defendant in his own words here. He claims he identified himself as a police officer when he confronted the victim.
As I got close to the vehicle, and the door swung open, and this guy jumps out, and I immediately got out of the van, and he's like, I'm okay, man. And at which point I said, hey, man, police, can I help you? And second I said police, he jumped back, and I clearly remember him drawing and pointing a gun at me. I saw that silver muzzle, and he had, I can swear on this, he had a Laser Max laser in the guide rod in the gun, and I saw that red light of that Laser Max flashing at me. And I immediately just shouted, drop the gun, and sorry.
Let's do this. Like, take a deep breath. Let's do this, okay? Do you need a drink?
No.
Okay.
Sure?
Listen, I want you to take your time.
Raja was driving in an unmarked van. It did not have a logo. It did not have flashing lights. Raja was not wearing a uniform, though he was wearing one earlier in his shift. What he might not have been counting on was this upcoming recording of a roadside assist call the victim made before Officer Raja approached. Nowhere in this call can Raja be heard identifying himself as a police officer. Here is the recording along with an FBI transcript. The first sound you will hear is the electronic chime generated by Corey Jones leaving his car door open.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's gunshots.
Testimony from the victim's brother discussed that very phone call. The brother compared the tone in Corey Jones's voice to other conversations.
He was very calm. He wasn't flustered or nothing like that. I just know that he was concerned about his drums and ready to get home because he already played.
Just pause. Pause for a second.
Did he sound angry at all?
No.
Did he sound as if he was impaired at all?
No.
Have you listened to a recording of an AT&T roadside assistance call from October 18th to 2015 from approximately 3 in the morning, sir?
Yes.
You recognize the person on that call?
Yes.
Who was that person?
That was Corey.
Any doubt about it?
No doubt.
He sounded the same on that recording initially as he had sounded when you talked to him?
He sounded like it was every day.
Did that change at the end of that call?
Yeah.
It's clear the state is trying to make former Officer Raja look like a liar in this case. Yesterday, a crime scene investigator testified he was unable to recreate a flickering red light, which Raja claimed was on the victim's gun. Raja apparently thought it was a flickering laser sight. The only thing authorities could recreate was a possible reflection from a red traffic light.
Guys, we were missing people. We had people. So, you are group two. You're number one in my heart.
We tried to get the red reflectivity and the flicker pattern. We got the red. We tried from several different angles, and we couldn't get the same flicker pattern or any flicker pattern. I was able to get I was able to view it with my eyes, and I was actually able to capture it with the camera, with the red traffic signal reflecting off the front of the pistol.
We were hoping to join an attorney who represents the victim's family. Apparently, he's been called to court for a hearing. So instead, forensic death examiner Joseph Scott Morgan is with me tonight. Joseph, thanks for saving the day.
Hey, good to be here.
Okay, so what do you make of this Raja case? We have a lot of moving parts, and as I said, we've got numerous instances. The flickering red light, the identification as a police officer where the state is saying this guy just isn't telling the truth about what happened. Why isn't he telling the truth? The state is arguing he's trying to cover his tracks for a crime. What do you make of it?
Yeah, listening to those recordings, I think for me is one of the most powerful things, Aaron. When these things are married up and they're synced, it's quite staggering, you know, what you're hearing relative to hearing the phone call that he's initiated roadside service, and then the phone call that he's made to 911. It's staggering. And the big point of order here, I think, for us right now is, why would Corey run away? Well, he's got a guy in an unmarked vehicle. There's no flashing lights, as you stated, no logo. And he's dressed in, you know, blue jeans, a ball cap. It's early in the morning. This kid has been broken down on the side of the road. He's tired. He's frustrated. And then you got a guy that's going to pull a gun at you and start hurling profanities at you. He hasn't identified himself as a police officer. It's very scary.
And I mean, it's a sort of nightmare that no one wants to live through if they're stranded on the side of the road in that situation. So why didn't this officer just pull out a badge or something, or call a marked squad car to render assistance or something like that? And if this particular individual who became the victim here was indeed up to no good, then someone in uniform would have been able to straighten that out right away. And of course, that wasn't the case. But the rule that I've always been told is unmarked officers don't pull over victims. They don't stop victims. They don't try to render assistance. They don't do anything like this.
Well, no, and I got to tell you, the van itself is a problem for me. If I'm standing on the side of the road and some stranger comes wheeling along and they stop in this kind of provocative, odd position forward of my vehicle like that, it's going to catch my attention. I'm going to be back on the defensive at this point in time, particularly if it's not a police officer. I'm going to say, What in the world's going on here? And so I would imagine that from Jump Street that this created a tense situation, and Raja should know better than this.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and poor Corey Jones is believing he's the victim of a robbery, a carjacking, right, something like that, and that's how he died, near the side of that interstate. Of course, the forensics may answer some of the questions. We have these long pauses. I went and counted. It was, I believe, between 8 and 9 seconds between the first round of shots that Raja fired and the second round, and that's a big chunk of time. That's a lot of time in there to get one's wits, and yet there was one round of gunfire, 8 to 9 seconds, and another round.
I counted as well. I concur with your assessment. I got 8 seconds. And again, this goes back, Aaron, to the key element here. Relative to police, police are held to a different standard than private citizens are when it comes to escalation of force. He has to go through various steps along the way before he can pull the weapon. I still do not understand why this weapon was drawn at this particular time. And it all goes back to how he stopped in this odd position in the middle of an off-ramp off of I-95. It's just, the whole thing is very bizarre to me.
Exactly. Joseph Scott Morgan will check in again with you later on in the broadcast. Back to court now for another trial we're following. This one is out of the state of California. Chase Merritt is accused of murdering his business partner, Joseph McStay, and McStay's entire family. The prosecution says the motive was money. The family disappeared in 2010. A dirt biker found the bodies of all four of the McStays buried in the desert. 3 years later in 2013. Today, cross-examination about McStay's attempts to communicate with a jailhouse, or not McStay rather, but Merritt's attempts to communicate with a jailhouse visitor without using the in-house phone system, which of course is a recorded line. Authorities tried to record conversations anyway using a different microphone. This testimony was bumpy, though, just like most of the rest of the case.
In Mr. Merritt's case, there's many conversations where they specifically, when I say they, I mean him and Michelle specifically is who he normally talks to, but he talks to multiple family members. They talk about, hey, we can't say this on the phone. And then they have the visits, and they don't use the phone because they know it's being recorded. So it's a conscious effort to circumvent the recording system.
Objection, speculation.
The last portion of the answer is strictly the objection system is cause for speculation and conclusion.
Was there more to your answer besides that?
Yes, sir.
Please continue.
So it appears to be an effort to circumvent...
Objection, speculation.
Okay.
So they're talking through the glass, so it's not recorded.
You can say what he did or didn't do, but you can't offer your opinion as to why he was doing it.
I apologize. Okay, so they are not using the phone, and they are talking through the glass as opposed to talking on the phone.
Testimony in that case continues into the evening. You can watch all of our raw feeds, of course, on lawandcrime.com. And now to Brian Ross for a look at what's ahead tonight on Brian Ross Investigates.
Thanks, Aaron. This week on our program, Gone Girl, the Alabama college student who sneaked away to Syria and became an ISIS bride. Now she says she wants to come home with her toddler son, regretting that she ever called for Americans to be murdered.
I know I ruined my future and my son's future, and I'm deeply, deeply.
Plus, our shout out for the reporters who uncovered children dying at three times the normal rates at a heart surgery unit run by one of the country's most prestigious medical institutions. All coming up tonight at 5:30 on Brian Ross Investigates. Aaron?
Brian, we'll see you then. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a Florida man learns his fate after a trial where prosecutors accuse him of murdering a mother of three. A look back at the key evidence which likely moved the jury. That, plus our expert analysis after the break. A guilty verdict in the case of a Florida man accused of murdering a mother of three. David Russell Holbrook Jr. faced the jury last night following the death of Melissa Howard. The victim's daughter found her stabbed and beaten in 2006. Howard had just won a child custody battle against her ex-husband. The ex-husband was a friend to the defendant. The ex-husband himself was at a large party at the time of the killing, giving him an alibi. To buy the state's case, the jury basically had to agree that this recording of Holbrook entering a local Walmart showed him just minutes after he stabbed the victim to death. Relatives, however, said Holbrook made his way back to a party after this recording without a drop of blood on him and that he was not acting strangely. One of the victim's daughters gave a sentencing statement on behalf of her family.
I just want to thank everyone here for their time and the commitment for FDLE, the Crestview Police Department, the State Attorney's Office, for finally getting justice for us. As anyone can expect, this has just been an awful ordeal. We haven't been with our mother for 13 years while he gets to go free and be with his children and his grandchildren. And our mother missed so many stuff, all of our graduations, me becoming a nurse, following in her footsteps. Her first grandchild born in December, my upcoming wedding in August, and everything else that a mother should never have to miss, let alone the children ever have to go through, because someone has such disregard for human life. I just want to thank everyone again that has put so much time into finally getting answers for us. Even though it took a little bit of time, we just want to appreciate everyone for this.
The prosecution said Holbrook's changing stories about his own timeline the night of the murder made him look guilty. Here are a few key points. Pay close attention again to the timeline.
We know there was a custody battle going on at this time for Taylor Howard. You heard from Janice Burke that Melissa Howard was successful and petitioning the court for primary custody of Taylor. She was slated to get full custody on January 6, 2006, the same day that she was killed. The defendant claimed he had not been to Melissa's house or even seen Melissa in years. Years! The truth is, he was at her house 2 days before her murder. The defendant's timeline for his activities that Friday changed every time he told it. On January 25th of 2006, he said he left the house at 8:30, stopped by Walmart, and was back by 9 o'clock. And that version of his story, the only time he left his house was between 8:30 and 9. He left at 8:30, dropped his kids off, and was home by 9. That's not what he said on February 1st, 2006. He said he left his house at 8:40 or 8:45. He arrived exactly at 9 o'clock, stopped by now a gas station in Walmart, and then arrived home between 9:20 and 9:30, 9:15, 9:30. It keeps changing, though. February 7th, 2006, he will say that he left his house at 8:20. When the officer repeats it back to him, he says, no, 8:40. Dropped his kids off right at 9 o'clock, stopped by a gas station at Walmart, and then arrived home at roughly 9:30. Let's talk about his actual timeline. If he left to take the kids home at 8:20 or 8:30, both of which are versions of his stories, not my words, his. If that version of the story is true, the kids would have been home by 8:35 or 8:45 because he said it takes 15 minutes to get there. We know there was a phone call from the defendant to Gina at 9:29 p.m. And we know that he and Michael entered Walmart at 9:35 or 9:37. Ladies and gentlemen, Russell Holbrook had plenty of time to kill Melissa Howard before he went to Walmart. Under this scenario, he had almost an hour.
The defense argued the state's timeline did not work and that this defendant had no motive to commit the murder for the victim's ex-husband. The defense pointed the finger instead at the defendant's own brother as being better friends with the ex, and the defense said the ex's alibi was not airtight.
You've heard no testimony that Russell and Brian Howard were close friends. Much less enough for Russell to murder someone as a favor for Brian Howard. We've heard no connections as to why Brian Howard would somehow convince or get Russell Holbrook to do something for him. They weren't good friends. Now, Michael Holbrook and Brian Howard, they knew each other. They had worked together. They had done jobs. And all you heard about Brian Howard, we heard from a lot of witnesses about the Azteca restaurant that night. And everybody seems to agree that people came home and it was roughly around the 9 o'clock hour. But that Brian goes upstairs never to be seen from again.
The defense said there was no sign of forced entry. So how then did Holbrook get into the house? The victim wouldn't have let him in because she was afraid of him, according to this testimony from the victim's lawyer.
What did she tell you was the reason that she was so upset?
The first thing that she said to me was, I knew this would happen. And I asked her, what did she mean by that? And she said that Brian sent one of his men over to scare me. I asked who it was, and she told me who it was.
How did she identify the person that had done this?
Well, right after she had answered the phone, she said he just left. And then she said, I knew he would do this. I had made an assumption that it was Brian. That's why I said, who was it? And she said that it was Russell.
Did you inquire who Russell was referring to?
I already knew who Russell was based on our prior conversations. However, I did ask her to specify exactly who she was talking about.
Did she?
She did.
And what did she say?
She used his full name. She said David Russell Holbrook.
Did she say what Russell told her? During the course of the visit, I mean, how does that relate to what was going on in Melissa Howard's life?
That was the 4th of January, and beginning on January the 6th is when Taylor was supposed to start living with her on a primary basis. And she told me that what Russell told her was, you need to let that boy be with his father, and you need to let this go.
So there were these threats, but again, the defense raised some key issues here. The defense also noted the victim's lover, a married man who was cheating on his own wife, had been to the victim's house earlier the night the victim was killed. That lover testified earlier in the case. The defense pointed to several pieces of evidence that suggest a case of botched police work here. Two beer bottles were at the murder scene. One was tested for DNA, the other was not. Plus, the lover on the stand right there drove a UPS truck. Investigators found some blood evidence on the truck, but never tested that for DNA either. The verdict, of course, guilty of murder in this case. Joining me once again tonight, forensic death examiner Joseph Scott Morgan. So, Joseph, the defense raised some rather disturbing points here, but if I were to guess, and I have not talked to a juror here, but if I were to guess, they were going to turn, they would say that this was a conviction because of what the attorney said about the defendant being in her house, making that threat a couple of days before the murder, and that one tiny piece of DNA on the victim's sweatshirt. That might have, those were probably the two things that sealed the case.
Yeah, I would have to think so. Janice Burke, the divorce attorney that took the stand, she was very credible, very controlled, and was very purposeful in what she said. So yeah, that's a compelling piece of evidence there. At least testimonial evidence. The DNA evidence, you know, from Jump Street, we've been looking at this and talking about contamination and all these sorts of things and calling in these DNA experts. And DNA is heady stuff anyway. It's difficult for the average person to understand, but then you get it in these circumstances where the waters are rather muddied because of dirty scissors and things like this. But still at the end, they were able to have connectivity, weren't they? And that in and of itself is very powerful.
Yeah, you know, exactly how did that DNA get there? Was it because the defendant went into the house and levied that threat a couple of days before? Because that's how the defense was trying to explain it away. Or did it get there during the attack? And look, either way the jury took it, the bottom line is this resulted in a conviction. And the victim's family was pleased. They seem confident in this one. So, Joseph Scott Morgan, I appreciate your input again tonight. And thanks again to those of you watching The Debrief. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern here on the Law & Crime Network with this nightly recap of the best moments of testimony in cases nationwide. See you tomorrow. We'll be right back.